welcome to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, November 14th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Waterloo Deer Workers Give Third Tentative Agreement a Frosty Reception. Temperatures didn't get above 40 degrees in Waterloo on Saturday, but it was the frosty reception from deer and UAW leadership that chilled striking local 838 workers to the bone. Deere & Co. and union officials reached a third preliminary contract agreement. It was announced Friday night, and workers who began striking 4 weeks ago will vote on it soon. But while striking workers hadn't yet seen the latest offer or gotten a highlighter sheet from the UAW leadership, picketers said that they heard it wasn't much more than the company's second offer. That was rejected by a wide margin in Waterloo, home to 3,100 of the 10,100 total striking workers. "We just want higher wages," said one picketer. "They can get rid of that ratification bonus." The United Auto Workers said in a statement Friday night that the proposed contract with the agricultural machinery giant includes modest modifications to the latest rejected proposal, which included immediate 10% raises. The union described the new proposal as the company's last, best, and final offer in its statement. But those on picket lines in Waterloo said Saturday that they thought the company was not bargaining in good faith, pointing to a recent letter sent to dozens of Waterloo-area business and community leaders from the John Deere Waterloo Works factory manager touting Deere's latest offer. UAW members said Deere was misrepresenting how much workers were paid, including CIP pay or pay for meeting quotas that they say Waterloo workers didn't routinely get because of shortages. If the latest offer didn't address that, Picketer said, the local will vote it down again, undeterred, even as winter creeps in. "Even with the gains that we made in the most recent offer, it doesn't really make up for what we've lost the last 24 years, another worker said, saying that they thought that target distribution workers make more up front. "I think Deere is interested in making that known that they've offered quite a bit, but I guess we don't feel like that." The contract, which union members will vote on Wednesday, would cover more than 10,000 Deere workers at 12 facilities in Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas, who make the company's iconic John Deere green tractors and other equipment. Deere officials had no comment. The modified agreement isn't just a tentative agreement, according to a release from Brian Rothenberg, spokesperson for the UAW. With the second tentative agreement, Deere announced it was their last, best, and final offer after the vote. This time, Deere officially declared, "This is the last, best, and final offer at the negotiating table, which could potentially trigger legal action," Rothenberg said. "I know it caused a lot of confusion," Rothenberg said. "I've had people say, well, you know it's a tentative agreement. Well, yes, it is, but it just has a different connotation to it if it goes down." James Cooney, employment law expert at Rutgers University, said although declaring best and final offers isn't unheard of, it doesn't take place in every labor negotiation. Employers often claim to be making a last best final offer as leveraging in bargaining to try and intimidate the union, Cooney said. Cooney said an official best and last offer could signify Deere is at an impasse in negotiations. The National Labor Relations Board requires an employer and unions to actively negotiate on employment terms until they agree on a labor contract or reach a standoff or impasse. An impasse is a total breakdown of the bargaining process that occurs after good faith negotiations have been exhausted, according to the NLRB. That's not an agreement with the company when saying, hey, this is our last best final offer, Cooney said. A union may take that back to the membership, but on the other hand, may choose not to, especially if it's perceived as more of a threat. And that's why there's probably more going on behind the scenes than certainly I'm aware of on both sides. If they are truly at an impasse and the union votes this offer down, Deere has the ability to implement the terms of it with employees working during the strike, Cooney said. Workers could be expected to continue their strike even if the agreement is implemented for remaining employees. If there is a true impasse, the law does allow an employer to unilaterally impose the conditions, but very often there is not a true impasse and a third party, such as the National Labor Relations Board, might disagree and that there is no further room for bargaining, Cooney said. The UAW could file an unfair labor practice charge with the NLRB if the new agreement is implemented, he said. In such cases, NLRB investigates, and if a company is found guilty of refusal to bargain, the NLRB can restore the old agreement and force the parties back to the negotiating table. But if the NLRB decides that the parties are at a true impasse, the company is legally allowed to implement the new agreement and hire replacement workers. It depends on so many moving parts, Cooney said. To keep negotiations open, Deere and the UAW could bring in a third-party mediator, like someone in the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service if they haven't already. I hope the parties will be open to a mediator getting involved, Cooney said, but that's really up to them. The next article we'll be reading is Grout Museum's renovated planetarium is immersive, out-of-this-world experience. The latest new attraction in Waterloo is an out-of-this-world experience. The 65-year-old planetarium at the Grout Museum District at 503 South Street has undergone a $200,000 renovation. With a simple touch of an iPad, a new state-of-the-art projection system will transport audiences to Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, or any other planet, galaxy, or star in the depths of ancient Mayan in jungle. The night sky at Christmas possibilities are endless, and all in astonishing detail. It is an immersive experience that is meant to educate, engage, and entertain visitors. We can land on any planet and explore. We can go forward and backwards in time. We can go into space in real time. We can put together our own shows or choose from a selection of available programming, said Alan Sweeney, Director of Facilities and Exhibits. Renamed the Norris Corson Family Planetarium, the museum's Star Chamber is one of the only three planetariums in Iowa that offers public programming. The planetarium is open for the members only through December 23rd. Beginning December 27th, it will open to the public showings. Installed in 1956, the planetarium underwent some renovations in 1976 with the installation of a new star projector. After nearly 50 years, none of the buttons or switches on the star ball worked anymore. When we closed because of COVID, that gave us the perfect time to start the renovation project, said Sweeney. He did the demolition work himself. The original star projector is now on a display case just outside the planetarium door. The planetarium now features a 4K laser projection system installed by Bowen Technovations from Indianapolis, a Digitalis planetarium control system, LED cover light, and 5.1 surround sound audio. A silver-tinted specialized coating was painted on the original dome, cove lighting installed for more lighting special effects, and 30 theater-style reclined seats installed. There's a new electrical system and carpeting as well. Sweeney described his first experience with the planetarium's new capability as jaw-dropping. It's so new that we're still trying to figure out all we can do. It's all computerized and integrated. Now we can just come in, push a button, swipe the iPad, and get a show going. It gives us so much flexibility. At a recent test showing for 30 third-grade students, the whole room erupted in cheers and applause, he said. Sweeney credits Barbara Corson, the driving force behind the renovation. Corson has been fascinated by the astronomy since childhood and a frequent traveler. She is an avid museum goer. We have a world-class museum in Grout, and I've always been thankful that the Grout had a planetarium, but after so many years, the equipment was no longer operational, Corson said. She took action and contacted Grout Museum Director Billy Bailey to organize a planetarium committee that would determine a plan and raise funds. The end result is fantastic, she said. In a new effort, opening new doors will begin January to raise funds to improve accessibility and functions for the museum and planetarium. Other planetarium contributors include Black Hawk County Gaming Association, Roy J. Carver Charitable Trust, Kathy Livingston Fund, the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa, the Lady Fund, the Sandra Rita Aleph, Sally Dara K. Kathy Brecknich, Frederick W. Mast Family Fund, and Greg and Lynette Harder. My apologies for any mispronunciations there. Admission to the planetarium is $6 for adults and $3 for children. Museum members are free. Members can view shows at 3 p.m. Wednesday and 11 a.m. and 1:30 and 3 p.m. Saturdays through December 23rd. From December 27th through 31st, the public can view shows at 11 a.m. and 1:30 and 3 p.m. After December 31st, weekday shows are at 3 p.m. and at 11 a.m., 1:30 and 3 p.m. Saturdays. Now, let's move on to an article, Courier Moving to Cedar Falls Industrial Complex. For 162 years, the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier has been the primary source of news, sports, and current events in the Cedar Valley. During this time, we have strived to be a true fourth estate serving our community. Needless to say, over the course of 162 years, many things have changed in our industry. The speed with which readers can access news is light years faster than it was just 10 years ago. As a result, our reporting is now instantaneous across our website and social media platforms. The Courier Newsroom has evolved to meet the demand for accurate and timely reporting and is now the leader in local news on these digital platforms. Another way the Courier is meeting demand of the modern workforce is through our advertising solutions. Historically, our print publication was the best way for local and regional businesses to reach the Cedar Valley. While the Courier's print publication is still a great way to market the Cedar Valley area, we have grown into a digital advertising and marketing powerhouse. We are now one of the largest advertising agencies in all of eastern Iowa, and our parent company, Lee Enterprises and Amplify Digital, is one of the most innovative media companies in the country. The lease on our current Waterloo location expires in December. While this location is a beautiful building in downtown Waterloo, it no longer meets all of our needs. As we explored various options for an office location over the past few years, we were drawn to the innovation and the opportunity that Cedar Falls Industrial Park offers. We have also developed a business partnership with Mud Advertising, a world-class automotive agency with 40 years of success, based right here in the Cedar Valley. Mud Development owns and leases exceptional office facilities in Cedar Falls Industrial Park, and we have decided to move our operations and personnel to an office building on their campus at the beginning of 2022. The new location will perfectly align with our future growth strategy while keeping us close to the Cedar Valley. Ultimately, we view all of the communities we serve as the Cedar Valley. One of the hardest things to do is change and adapt to an ever-advancing world while keeping true to your foundations. Our commitment to the Cedar Valley community remains, and we will continue to be the beacon of news in our region. That was a note from the Courier itself. And now we can move on to the next article of more enrolled in Cedar Falls schools because of growing residential base. More students are attending Cedar Falls Community Schools this fall, but much of the increase is coming from families who live in the district rather than those who open enroll in them. The official count taken October 1st shows that there were 5,706 kindergarten through 12th grade students enrolled in the district's 10 schools, 112 more than a year earlier. Superintendent Andy Petit said that this is largely due to a growth in Cedar Falls subdivisions creating new housing stock in the city. Data shows an increase of 98 students who are residents of the district. Of the remaining increase, 8 were attending Cedar Falls School through open enrollment for a total of 293 this fall. We did not have a real significant increase from open enrollment in this year due to multiple factors. We didn't accept all students because of capacity issues, said Petit. Generally, the district had space available in its elementary schools, but not at its junior highs and only limited space at the high school. While that led to denial of some requests, the superintendent said that those decisions also caused some families who get denials and approvals for multiple children not to enroll any of them. Students had an extended opportunity to open enroll out of and into neighboring Waterloo Community Schools after a new state law banning the use of its voluntary diversity plan was signed in May. Between then and the start of September, Waterloo officials said that 151 students did open enroll out with students switching to Cedar Falls schools, accounting for at least a third. The relatively stable number of students open enrolling in the Cedar Falls district over the 2 years may indicate a similar amount of graduated or left after last spring as others came into the system this fall. More students are enrolled in the district at each level. Although most of the elementary schools now have a slight decline because of virtual students are counted separately from the building, unlike last year. The seven elementary schools had 21 more students for a total of 3,051. Secondary schools had 91 more and an increase of 21 at the two junior highs and an additional 70 at the high school. The virtual campus includes 78 students, 48 elementary, 21 junior high, and 9 high school. The district had 95 students learning online from home in fall of 2020, a number Patti estimated had dropped to close to 400 students when school ended last spring. Currently, the program is smaller, but certainly fills the academic needs for some of our families and students, as far as that being an option, he said. It is being provided for a combination of health and safety reasons, offering a greater flexibility through the use of technology. While the emergence of COVID-19 made it necessary to offer the online option last year, we had started this work pre-pandemic, said Patti. It got accelerated through the pandemic, but is certainly something that we plan to continue. And then here's a subheader that says, funding numbers up. Cedar Falls budget enrollment of 5,565.72 is an increase of more than 109.3 more pupils. The number is used in a formula to determine the per pupil state funding level for districts. The decimal point accounts for students who are homeschooled or enrolled in non-public schools while taking some district or college classes. It includes adjustments to the actual number of students in the schools, accounting for those who come into or leave the district. Funds for the open enrolled students, plus seven others attending Cedar Falls schools for special education purposes, are received from the districts where they reside. Cedar Falls also gets funding for 34 preschool students with individual education programs and 5.22 homeschooled or non-public school pupils, who can take college or high school classes through the district. Open enrollment out of the district is 104.5 pupils, growing by about 2 since last year. That is one category of students added to the budget enrollment, with funds passed on to the district where the child attends. There is also 21 students who are tuitioned out, typically because they have disabilities and need to be served in a different setting. Counted separately are the 167 children who open enrolled in the district's free 4-year preschool program, which for half of the regular K-12 per pupil funding is received from the state. Now let's move on to the article, AP Explainer. Did Rittenhouse lawyers do enough to prevail? Kyle Rittenhouse, testifying about the night he shot three men on the streets of Kenosha, sobbing and seemingly unable to continue as he spoke about the first shooting, was among the most compelling moments in his 2-week murder trial. It might also have been the most effective part of the 3-day defense case, potentially swaying any jurors inclined towards sympathy for the 18-year-old who has claimed self-defense for killing two men and injuring one. Prosecutors say the primary case of the violence was Rittenhouse's decision to go to Kenosha with a rifle in a city racked by protesters after a white police officer shot a black man, Jacob Blake. Rittenhouse, who was 17 at the time, is charged with multiple counts including intentional and reckless homicide, as well as a possession of a dangerous weapon by a minor. He and the man he shot are white. Here is a look at how the presentation went for the defense, which rested its case Thursday. And here's a little subheader question that says, how did Rittenhouse's testimony go? The defense's most consequential decision was to put Rittenhouse on the stand to let him tell jurors what was going through his mind when he opened fire. Andrew Branca, a Colorado lawyer who wrote the book The Law of Self-Defense Principles, said on his blog about the trial that the decision was a high-stakes bet by the defense and one that is always at has risk of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Defendants claiming self-defense don't have to testify, but there's pressure on them to do so since what they were thinking when they used lethal force is so central to determining guilt. The risk was Rittenhouse would get tripped up, rattled, or provoked by aggressive questioning from prosecutors, and that he would blurt out something that hurt his case. But for most of his some 6 hours testifying, his claim was he was calm, answering questions politely and succinctly. He didn't wilt or lash back. Lead prosecutor Thomas Binger pressed Rittenhouse, asking him if it was true that he intended to kill all three men. Rittenhouse responded, "I didn't intend to kill them. I intended to stop the people who were attacking me." His display of apparent emotion just minutes into his testimony, leading the judge to call a brief recess, may have helped his case with jurors, some legal experts say. "There is public debate as to the sincerity of Rittenhouse's tears," said Louis J. Shapiro, a Los Angeles lawyer. "If the jury accepts them as genuine, then it will bode well for Rittenhouse." Branca, who told the Associated Press previously that he thought Rittenhouse should have been acquitted, said Rittenhouse's testimony went well for the defense. Another subheader question, what else stood out about the defense case? The defense achieved a lot before even starting their presentation to jurors. Some witnesses for the state clearly helped the defense. A stark example was when one of the prosecution's earliest witnesses, a videographer Richie McGinnis, described the first man Rittenhouse killed, Joseph Rosenbaum, charging Rittenhouse screaming "F you" and lunging for Rittenhouse's rifle. It was also prosecutors who entered the extensive video evidence that backed the defense view that Rittenhouse was being chased when he shot Rosenbaum, and moments later Anthony Huber and Gage Grosskreutz. The video showed Grosskreutz with a gun in his hand as he approached Rittenhouse. Joe Lopez, a Chicago-based defense attorney, said that he didn't see calling such witnesses as a mistake by prosecutors. He said prosecutors often want to be the ones entering evidence that is unavoidably favorable to the defense, rather than leaving it for the defense to do so. Next subheader. What else did the defense accomplish? Since so many key issues were broached and thrashed out in cross-examination during the state's week-long case, the defense has less to do. Besides putting Rittenhouse on the stand for much of Wednesday, the defense also called a series of witnesses in an effort to show he displayed no aggression or ill intent on the night and helped to clean graffiti that day and put out fires at night. With prosecutors trying to focus jurors on the totality of what Rittenhouse did, starting with his decision to come to Kenosha with a gun, the defense tried to steer them towards a micro view, with one defense expert zeroing in Thursday on the 2:55 from when Rosenbaum started chasing Rittenhouse. Self-defense is the debate that the defense wants the jury having it in the jury room, Shapiro said. Not the question of why didn't Rittenhouse mind his own business and stay away from the protest. The next article we'll be moving on to is Some Deer Workers Are Turning to Temp Jobs to Survive the Strike. When Rebecca Burns, owner of the Shameless Chocoholic and Moline, was staffing up for the holiday season, she went directly to the picket lines. "My husband actually works for Deer. He's a pipe fitter, so he's involved with the strike, and I know he's struggling right now to keep everything paid," Burns said. "I know a lot of other people are as well, and we're coming into our holiday season. Temporary help is great during the holiday season for us, so it worked out well." The striking employee, who declined to comment, went from producing Deer construction and agriculture equipment to packaging Christmas candies and gifts. Burns said that the worker is proving essential services for a successful holiday season. "It frees me up to do the things I need to be doing," Burns said. Burns said that other striking workers asked about part-time employment, and she wishes she could hire more than one person. Unfortunately for us, this is our quiet time, so I have to be very careful about how much I take on for payroll until the money actually starts coming in, Burns said. You have to prep in order to get the money, but it's very quiet, especially in downtown Moline. As the strike passes the four-week mark, more striking deer workers are looking for temporary employment opportunities to support themselves and their families. As the weeks drag on, savings and strike pay might not be sufficient to get union members through the holiday season. I just hope that they can come to a resolution quickly for these people, because a lot of them are going to start struggling very soon, Burns said. And here's a subheader that says, Income Streams. One worker from John Deere Parts Distribution Center in Milan said strike pay and savings are not enough to support his family, which includes two children. He started a temporary job days after going on strike. There are some people that might be able to manage on strike pay, but when you've got a family, kids, all that, it's a little difficult to just use that $275, the worker said. For me, it was a no-brainer just to go and find something. The UAW provides $275 weekly strike pay for union members after the eighth day of a strike. It's paid out of the strike fund, which is built through union dues. In order to be eligible, members must be in good standing on their union dues, on active payroll at the time of strike, and participate in the strike. If a member takes a job that pays more than $275 a week, they must forgo strike pay. Local unions disperse the payments to their members, according to Brian Rothenberg, UAW spokesman, who said that the UAW's strike fund had a balance of more than $790 million last time he checked. Even though he no longer qualifies for strike pay, the worker said that the part-time job allows him to be ready to go for the future. I don't know if there's going to be a long strike or they're going to wrap it up soon, the worker said. I'm just kind of preparing for the worst. Organized community support also is available to deer workers in the Quad Cities, according to Angel Richmond, administrator for the QC support of the John Deere Strikers Facebook group. The page coordinates food and supply drives and other services for those on strike. Richmond, whose son and husband work for Deere, organizes food and toiletry drives funded through a GoFundMe account. We're going to make sure that people are taken care of, Richmond said. I don't want to see babies going without diapers or wipes because their parents couldn't afford them, or formula for that matter. Anything I can help them with, I will try to do. Another subheader of finding a temp job. For the Milan worker, finding a temporary job was easy. I've got a pretty decent idea of where I could go if I needed to find a job, the worker said. But there may not be people in that same situation. Patty Rock, owner of Hoff Resumes and Career Coaching, said that it is difficult for striking workers to get jobs that require a significant amount of training. Companies are wary of hiring someone if they know they're going to go back, Rock said. Rock said a temp agency can help them find potential jobs, or they can network through family and friends. There are also retail positions that don't require technical skills, Rock said, and they are often looking for temp workers for the holidays. They're not going to make as much because people at Deere here make really good money, Rock said, but they could work and look at some of these places, like their hardware stores. If employees have computer skills, they can also use online agencies to find remote work done by computer. There's definitely work out there, the Milan worker said. A final subheader is tight labor market. In the midst of a national labor shortage, workers have access to job opportunities that offer competitive wages because cooperations are still struggling to attract and retain employees, according to Dave Swenson, economist at Iowa State University. Workers are in somewhat of an advantaged position when regarded to seeking jobs, Swenson said. Swenson said that one disadvantage is the striking employees don't know how long they can commit to the job. There are temporary jobs or part-time jobs or other kinds of jobs with flexible arrangements that exist in your economy, Swenson said, but they're not going to be able to replace a lot of the other kinds of demanded labor that's in your economy. Deere employs 3,950 people across the four Quad Cities plants, according to Deere statistics. The company also works with 301 suppliers in the Quad Cities and spends $783 million in transactions with those businesses. With the ongoing strike, Swenson said the Quad Cities economy is going to struggle with families having decreased disposable income and suppliers not maintaining the same level of production. However, workers on strike taking up temporary jobs can help alleviate some of the financial pressures. Anything that striking workers can do to bring in pay beyond their strike pay is going to be beneficial to their households. Most importantly, but also beneficial to the economy, Swenson said. That's going to be money that's going to be spent locally. Although there is a possibility that some workers will stay with the new jobs and not return to Deere, Swenson said it is unlikely because of the competitive wages and benefits Deere offers. We have seen this on longer strikes. It wears down the strikers over a period of time out of necessity. They have to take second jobs, even if the strikes are resolved, Swenson said. That's a risk the union has, but it's also a risk the company has from a prolonged strike, because every time you lose a worker, you lose a bundle of skills that add value to your plant and that have to be replaced. When asked if Deere was concerned about losing skilled labor to other jobs during the strike, Jen Hartman, spokesperson at Deere, said, "Our priority is to get employees back to work as a ratified contract." The Milan worker said that the lack of income will not impact his vote on the next tentative agreement. He hopes others aren't persuaded by financials either. "I think the majority of us know what we're fighting for and understand that this wasn't going to be easy," the worker said. "I'm not saying it won't hit some people eventually, but the majority are in for the long haul." You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, November 14th on Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Pauline A. Bolt. Pauline A. Bolt, 93, of Fredericksburg, died Wednesday, November 10th, 2021, at Maple Crest Manor in Fayette. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, November 15th, 2021, at Peace United Church of Christ in Fredericksburg, with Reverend Scott Smith officiating. Burial will follow at Rose Hill Cemetery in Fredericksburg. Visitation will precede services at the church on Monday, starting at 10 a.m. Memorials may be made to the family for later designation. Becker & Son Funeral Home in Sumner is assisting Pauline's family. Online condolences may be left at www.becker-rettig.com. Pauline Arlene, daughter of Paul and Viola Hunt, was born September 9, 1928, in Sumner. She received her education in the Sumner schools and graduated from Sumner High School in 1946. Pauline would continue her education at Upper Iowa University in Fayette. On January 18, 1947, she was united in marriage with Bernard Bolt in Denver, Iowa. To this union, four children were born: Elaine, Joanne, Paul, and Dale. Pauline was baptized and confirmed in 1954 at St. Peter's Evangelical and Reformed Church, now known as Faith United Church of Christ in Tripola. Pauline and Bernard farmed in rural Sumner area for many years prior to retiring in 1992 and moving to Fredericksburg. In addition to farming, Pauline worked at Chamberlain Manufacturing in Waterloo, and starting in the late 1960s and retiring in 1984. She was a member of Faith United Church of Christ in Tripola prior to becoming a member of Peace United Church of Christ in 1991. Pauline enjoyed traveling with her husband, playing cards, especially euchre and shapkov, and was an avid gardener and enjoyed fishing. Pauline is survived by her children, Elaine Wedemeyer of Sumner, Joanne Behrens of Charles City, Paul Bolt of Sumner, and Dale Bolt of Portugal, 10 grandchildren, 20 great-grandchildren, 5 great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren, brothers-in-law, Daryl Miller of Washburn, and sister-in-law, Glenice Bolt of Vinton. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband, Bernard, in 2014, grandson William Bolt, sister Joyce Miller, and son-in-law Donald Behrens. Douglas Henry Miller. Douglas Henry Miller, 75, of Cedar Falls, passed away on Wednesday, November 10th, 2021, at Unity Point Allen Memorial in Waterloo. Doug was born on March 23rd, 1946, in Independence, Iowa, the son of Glenn and Arlene Miller. He was baptized and confirmed at the American Lutheran Church in Jessup. He graduated from Jessup High School in 1964. He was united in marriage to Janice Christofferin on October 10th, 1965, at the American Lutheran Church in Jessup. They were blessed with two children, Terry and Ryan. Doug served in the U.S. Army from 1966 through 1969, which included a one-year tour of duty during the Vietnam War. He graduated from the University of Northern Iowa in 1974 with a bachelor's degree in accounting and 1995 with a master's degree in industrial technology. Doug loved his faith, his family, and his friends. Doug also had a love for farming and his country. Doug grew up helping his dad on dad farm and continued to farm until 2017. He was a member of the Acker Matthias American Legion Post 653 in Denver, where he served on honor guard. Doug has been a member of St. Peter Lutheran Church in Denver for more than 45 years. He served on the church council, ministry boards, and team committees. He also served on the Bartles Lutheran Retirement Community Board in Waverly for several years. He has held various management positions with John Deere in Waterloo for 31 years and was the director of the Metal Casting Center for the Industrial Tech Department at the University of Northern Iowa for 6 years. Doug loved the time that he spent with grandchildren, and he enjoyed hunting and fishing with his dad, son, and friends. Doug also enjoyed traveling with his wife, friends, and family, and watching his beloved Iowa Hawkeyes. A favorite place was their cabin in Harper's Ferry. They made memories boating on the Mississippi River with family and friends. Doug is survived by his wife, Janice Miller, of Cedar Falls, a daughter, Terry Hahn, of Anchorage, Alaska, a son, Ryan Miller, of Marion, two grandchildren, Reese and Braden Miller, a sister, Glenda Eccles, of Polk City, a brother, Richard Miller, of Waverly, and sister-in-law, Julie Miller, of Aurora, Colorado. He was preceded in death by his parents, a brother, Rodney Miller. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Tuesday, November 16th, 2021, at the St. Peter Lutheran Church in Denver, with Pastor Scott McCluskey officiating. Burial will be held in the Garden of Memories in Waterloo, with military rites at the grave conducted by the Acker Matthias American Legion Post 653 in Denver. Visitation will be held on Monday, November 15th, 2021, from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Kaiser Korten Funeral Home in Denver, and also for 1 hour prior to services on Tuesday at the church. Memorials may be directed to St. Peter Lutheran Church, Iowa City Hope Lodge/American Cancer Society, or the Denver American Legion. Kaiser Korten Funeral Home in Denver is assisting the family with arrangements. Tyler David Green. Tyler David Green, 31, of Waterloo, Iowa, died November 10, 2021, at the surgical ICU of University of Iowa Hospitals after being struck by a car while out in his wheelchair. He survived a traumatic birth on February 7, 1990, after which he spent his first 6 weeks of life receiving wonderful care at the neonatal ICU of the same hospital. Tyler fully accepted, even embraced, his cerebral palsy and other disabilities. It was simply who he was. Despite being told what he would not be able to do, Tyler spent a lifetime of doing. Tyler started advocating for people with disabilities when he was 8 years old, speaking to classes at the University of Northern Iowa with his mother, Gina. He graduated from West Waterloo High School in 2008. He He earned his associate's degree at Hawkeye Community College and continued his education at the University of Northern Iowa, earning a bachelor's degree in sociology. Tyler was involved in life in every way. His Eagle Scout project was creating a short educational DVD about ability awareness. The DVD, I'm Tyler, Don't Be Surprised, was distributed to all school districts in Iowa for training of educators and administrators. It is still offered for a free will donation on his website, www.iamtyler.org. Over 13,000 DVDs have been requested from all 50 states and 29 countries to date. But the most conservative estimates, well over a million people around the world have learned about ability awareness through Tyler. It continues yet today. Tyler was asked to provide keynote presentations at dozens of local, regional, and national conferences across the country. Audiences from 100 to 1,800 were inspired by Tyler's message of ability awareness. Ability awareness is simply the skill of recognizing that what someone can do is much more important than what they can't do. Those audiences include the Joint Commission of the Navy Air Force in Dallas, Kids Included Together in San Diego, the National Shand of the UCC at Hartford, the Department of Defense and FDA in Chicago, and so many others. In 2008, the U.S. Congress held a reception in Tyler's honor, and to celebrate the 18th birthday of the American with Disabilities Act, where he was asked to speak on ability awareness. Tyler was selected to participate in a collaboration of teenagers in Washington, D.C., who created the national I Am Norm campaign. I Am Norm promoted the concept that we are all normal who we are. We are who we are. Tyler also served on national committee Kids as Self-Advocates, who discussed issues and created supporting documents concerning people with disabilities. Tyler was a member of several other local and state committees and councils. Because of his tenure, the State of Iowa Special Education Advisory Panel, he was asked to review and offer edits to the State of Iowa Manual for Paraeducators. Tyler received many awards for his efforts and for simply being Tyler. Among them were the United Church of Christ National Disabilities Ministries Award and the Yes I Can Award for advocacy bestowed by the National Council for Exceptional Children. The Iowa CEC chapter started awarding an annual Tyler Achievement Scholarship the same year. Tyler was the inclusion coordinator for Together We Play, a part of the Inclusion Connection in the Cedar Valley. In that role, he partnered with organizations in Iowa to help them create more inclusive programming and activities. Tyler was an active member of 1st Congressional UCC of Waterloo and Three House Collaborative Campus Ministries at UNI. Tyler was full of love and compassion for others, especially those often marginalized by our world. He would want you to be kind and love others. Please do. Tyler is survived by his mother and father, Gina and Paul Green, his sister Molly Bishop, his brother Lucas Green, his nephews and niece, who loved him so dearly, Wesley and Zachary and Ellison Bishop, his grandfather David Green, grandmother Eddie Swim, and so many aunts, uncles, and cousins, and dear friends that he considered family. He was preceded in death by his grandparents Marion Green and William Swain. Tyler loved his whole family deeply. His dream was to change the world, and he has. An open memorial service will be held at the Karensbrook Auditorium of West Waterloo High School, 425 East Ridgeway Avenue, Waterloo, Iowa, on Saturday, November 20th, 2021, at 10:30 a.m., with a light lunch and time to visit the family immediately following the service in the West High Commons. Masks are encouraged. Memorial may be made to Tyler Green Scholarship, CO Waterloo Community Foundation, and the PO box is 1253 at 426 Cedar Street, Suite 320, Waterloo, Iowa 50704, or Inclusion Connection, which addresses 3510 Kimball Avenue, Waterloo 50701. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralhome.com. Now, let's move over to some sports articles, starting with Hogan wanted a medal at state diving, left with a championship. All Avery Hogan aimed for on Friday was to dive well enough to get a top six finish and a spot on the podium. I did not think that there was a single chance I would have won it, Hogan said. Yet her coach, Amy Kimball, told her that the field was wide open to where the junior could win the whole thing. She was really keen on the fact that I could be one, two, or three, Hogan said. Coaches know best. Hogan, who attends Waterloo Columbus Catholic and dives for the combined Waterloo team, put together a score of 470.10. That was 25 points higher than her seeded score to claim her first ever state diving title at Marshalltown YMCA. I just had to hit all of my dives good as I could, which I hadn't really done at all in the season, Hogan said. It was a neck-and-neck battle between Hogan and Grinnell Jr. Trisha Thompson, yet by the late rounds there was a handful of divers whose scores were all near each other. That didn't faze Kimball's thinking or her lone diver could leave on top. Hogan and Thompson went head-to-head at the regional meet in Fort Dodge, but Thompson didn't score a dive. We cleaned up a few other dives and we worked to get her voluntary dives perfect, Kimball said. The last 3 weeks of the season, Avery has worked so hard to do that. I wasn't pulling her leg when I said the state title was wide open. The top of the podium was hers for the taking. Hogan's final dive was the back twister. She admitted it was the dive she routinely worked on and practiced during the week and was never satisfied with how it was going. It was also a dive that was heightened for extra difficulty. It had not been going like I had hoped it would, Hogan said. Still, the mindset was as long as Hogan hit all of her dives to her ability, she would be in contention. At the regional meet in Fort Dodge, she felt like her best diving was still ahead of her. She was right. The back twister was the same dive that Thompson did on her final attempt. Hogan's score was higher, and that sealed the win. Kimball was close to coaching back-to-back state championship divers. Her daughter, Lauren, was number one seed last year and broke her hands 2 days before the finals. Hogan drove and placed 10th. So Kimball was more than thrilled about what happened on Friday. I expected big things from her because I knew that she could do it, Kimball said. It was incredible to see Avery work really hard this season and reach that goal. The scores for most of Hogan's season were right around that 440 mark. She didn't light the scoreboard up with a lifetime best, but was always consistent. From last year to this year, that was the biggest improvement that Kimball saw in her. She took every bit of feedback and she put it into place, Kimball said. Hogan has 1 year left of diving at the prep level, with sights on back-to-back state titles. She noted that some of her competitors put in plenty of diving time in the off-season. While Hogan does as well, the plan is to amplify it this off-season. This year, I'm hoping to get new dives and dive more, she said. Thinking about diving at the next level is something that Hogan is open to. Winning her first state title has boosted her confidence in that thinking. That's what I would want to do, but I have never talked to any schools, Hogan said. Just keep working hard and seeing what I can do. To Kimball, she sees plenty of avenues for Hogan to consider collegiately if she wants to keep diving. She is going to get calls and emails because I think she turned a few heads, Kimball said. She certainly has the potential to be a college diver. Next article is Dyke New Hartford plays with chip on shoulder all the way through semi-loss. Don Betts has been pretty open when talking about expectations set inside the Dyke New Hartford locker room this season. The Wolverines expected a lot of themselves, and for a while, no one else did. That allowed them to play with the motivation technique used quite a bit in the worlds of sports. It is one thing to have a chip on your shoulder, which they did, and it's another thing to put in the time and effort, Betts said. That's what I love about this team. They were relentless. That chip never left. Despite losing to West Sioux 24-21 in double overtime in the Class 1A semifinals on Friday at the UNI Dome, no one was overcome with emotions afterwards. There was sadness, there was disappointment of coming a field goal shy of a state title game appearance, yet the feeling of coming this far allowed Betts and players to start reflecting. The distance the seniors came when they were freshmen to here is nothing short of amazing, Betts said. All summer long we pushed it, senior Nathan Graves said. We were physical. 1 year ago, Dyke New Hartford was saying goodbye to some stout seniors in the second round of the pod playoffs after it fell to South Central Calhoun by 8 points. Gone was its starting quarterback, running back top, receiver, and best tackler. We had a lot of kids who were sitting behind really good players, Betts said. All the Wolverines had waiting in the wings was a 2,000-yard rusher, a quarterback that threw for 1,500 yards, and a host of players that created one of the top defenses in 1A, and had perfect season to boot. We stayed focused and stayed in the weight room, Graves said. It got us pretty far. The Falcons had over 500 yards of total offense compared to just over 120 for the Wolverines, and the game went into overtime tied at 14 behind two interception returns for touchdowns by Dyke New Hartford. That defense was getting bent numerous times throughout the 48-plus minutes. It broke in the overtime periods. They put drives together against us, but we couldn't stop them in their territory. Junior Nick Renicki said, we played well. What killed Dyke New Hartford's chances was an offense that went cold at the wrong time and could never sustain a drive. It didn't help that three key players missed some second half time due to injury. As Benz put afterwards, nothing was clicking. We couldn't hit any of our passes, he added. In the end, we just couldn't get anything going offensively. Jacob Stockdale, the Wolverines' quarterback, played his final game. The only other player that took snaps under center that is likely to be back is Benton Bixby. Jerick Hall returns as the tailback, and Micah Watson proved that to be a capable second option. Graves and Devin Kolash graduate and leave over 1,000 remaining yards needing to be replaced. Most of the secondary is gone, but Renecki and Will Textor plan to anchor the line of scrimmage. If anything, getting to this point is what Betts is hopeful spurs a consistent trend. Bottom line, they better be paying attention, Betts said. These guys have gone about it the right way. Now on to college football. Late stops let number 19 Iowa beat Minnesota 27-22. Keep Floyd. Alex Padilla threw for two touchdowns and ran for another in his first career start, and number 19 Iowa withstood three fourth-quarter comeback attempts to beat Minnesota 27-22 on Saturday. The Hawkeyes led the 24-16 before Minnesota's Tanner Morgan threw a 68-yard touchdown pass to Chris Autumn Bell with 5 minutes and 28 seconds to play. The Gophers went for the 2-point conversion, but Morgan's pass was tipped by Iowa safety Dane Belton and fell incomplete. The Gophers got the ball back on their own 10-yard line with 3 minutes and 8 seconds left. Morgan was sacked for a 7-yard loss on the second down, and his fourth down pass was broken up by Iowa's Matt Hankins. Caleb Shudak's 29-yard field goal provided the final margin, and then the Hawkeyes' defense bowed up to one more time when Minnesota drove to the Iowa 39. The game ended when Joe Evans sacking Morgan. Padilla's 1-yard touchdown drive in the second quarter put Iowa up 10-3. He threw a 72-yard touchdown pass to Charlie Jones early in the third quarter to give the Hawkeyes a 17-13 lead. Minnesota had a chance to take the lead down to 17-16 to start the fourth quarter, but Dragan Keish's 53-yard field goal attempt was blocked by Logan Lee. 5 plays later, Keegan Johnson took a short pass from Padilla and turned it into a 27-yard touchdown. Padilla, who took over for injured quarterback Spencer Petras in last week's 17-12 win at Northwestern, completed 11 of 24 passes for 206 yards. The Gophers had 189 rushing yards. That was the most this season against the Hawkeyes, who came into the game ranked 8th nationally in rushing defense at 98.6 yards per game. Kai Thompson rushed for 126 yards to lead the Gophers, who haven't won in Iowa City since 1999. Matthew Chickett had three field goals for the Gophers. Minnesota's other touchdown came in the second quarter on backup quarterback Cole Kramer's 37-yard pass to tight end Co. Kieft. The Hawkeyes kept Floyd of Rosendale the Bronze Pig Trophy awarded to the winner in the rivalry each season. The tradition began in 1935, and the Hawkeyes have a 43-42 edge in the series since. The Hawkeyes won their seventh consecutive game over the Gophers. It was Minnesota's 10th consecutive loss on the road in this series. The Hawkeyes are tied with Wisconsin for first in the Big Ten West, but the Badgers own tiebreaker because of their 27-7 win over the Hawkeyes on October 30th. The Gophers dropped out of what was a four-way tie at the start of the day. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, November 14th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.